Make My Life a Prayer to You, sung for us by Kathy Tricoli. We heard Heaven Bound from Andrew Eastman, and from Amy Grant, Carry You. It's 11 and a half after the hour. It's a Wednesday. And here on Broken Road Radio, that typically means a visit from Doug Greenwald. And I look at my screen, and there he is. Hello, Doug. Good morning to you.
Hi, guys. Good morning.
Morning, Doug.
Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times, a ministry based near Washington, actually in Columbia, Maryland. But are you close to the Chesapeake Bay there?
I am probably 30 minutes away from Annapolis, okay, where there is a ton of boating activity.
They train sailors at Annapolis, don't they?
They certainly do.
Well, David, really? David could use some advice here. David is the proud owner of a newly acquired sailboat, aren't you, David?
Yes, I am.
And how much did this run you now, this new boat?
Well, this 1962 O'Day Sailor, 17-footer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was at the Lions auction, and they had four sailboats in the enclosure, and they were the last items on the block to bid on, and the auctioneer couldn't get a bid at all. Mm-hmm. Nothing. And he said, anybody, $10 for choice? And I said, I'll take that.
Yeah.
I said, I'll give you $10. And he says, okay, I got 10, 25. 25, do I hear 25? Do I hear 30, 30, 30, 35? Do I hear 12? Do I hear 11? Do I hear $10.50? No. Sold $10 over there to the young man with the big grin on his face.
All right. David lives on a lake, too, so that boat may see the water someday. So we're looking at maybe, do you need sailing lessons, David? Maybe Doug could help you with the technique, you know?
All of it. I need all of it.
Well, now, let me make the following observation.
Okay.
One of the first boats I ever sailed on was a 17-foot O'Day Sailor.
Oh,
really?
We've talked to the right guy.
On Lake Pontchartrain in Louisiana in the 60s.
All right.
Really?
It would have been, Dave's boat would have been new then.
Yeah, those boats were fairly new in the 60s.
They were manufactured between 58 and 80-something, 85, I think it was.
Okay, no longer.
But there's something like, 20 or 30,000 boats of like that, O'Day Sailors, around. But mine is mine's in good shape. What did you sail yours yourself?
I crewed.
Okay.
I've also crewed on a 35-foot Melody class.
Oh, we're talking to the right guy here.
Oh, really? Yeah.
But you know, maybe I don't have much wisdom, but I can pass along this. The wind can either be for you or against you.
Okay. All right. Okay. That's good.
And it depends on how you manage the wind.
Aha! Well, so you need outside forces even then.
Doug, we could have guessed that.
You know, David, if the wind isn't blowing, don't go out.
Oh, let me write that down. Wind not blowing.
Well, then you could probably Google,
okay, anything else?
Google a sailing manual.
And when the winds blow, put the sails up.
Sails? Oh, sails up.
A source of good advice here.
Oh, you mean those kind of bedsheet looking things?
Yeah, and okay. here's the key point.
Oh, good stuff.
When you leave the dock, pull up the anchor.
Oh, I don't know if he has an anchor. Do you have an anchor on that?
It has an anchor? No, I don't think I have an anchor.
Well, the boat's going to be $10. The anchor about 45, I think.
Well, you know, so far everything I've tried to buy to fix the boat is going to be more than $10.
Well, I think it's going to be a dry dock for a while. David asked me how long do you have until you license it, and I figure he could take 8-10 years before he gets that.
DNR wants 30 days.
No, 30 days. That's before you can put it on the water. If it turns out to be a planter.
If it's gonna decorate your backyard somewhere, then you never have to register it.
Well, thank you for that advice, Doug. We appreciate
it. Well, there's one more here too.
Wow.
This is appropriate for a newsman.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
When you sail into the wind, you have to tack.
Oh.
In other words, you have to go at 45-degree angles in the direction that the wind is blowing, so to speak.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And as a newsman, you always have to discern and be very tactful in how you present the news. So this should be pretty easy for you.
Or tacky. You could be tacky, I suppose, too. You do what?
Well, people are pretty tacky the way some boats are sailed, too. You know, it's a fine line.
And there's a whole new lingo here. He has to learn words like ahoy and luft and hoist the mainsail.
And port
starboard. Do you know what a luft is?
Yeah, port starboard.
Do you know what a luft is?
It's when the wind isn't blowing, right? And the sail is just kind of
Yep.
No,
it's flopping in the breeze.
No, it's when you go down to the sailboat and it's it's floating there in the water and the sun is setting. You look at the boat and you say, "I love you."
You see. Okay.
You know, there's one more thing. Maybe this will be a whole series of one more things. But when you're tacking into the wind and you change directions, duck your head.
Oh, yeah. They're good.
Because the boom is going to come swinging over the cockpit.
A cockpit and a boom now. There's two more words you have to.
Man. My education's just going skyward. It's just right off the charts.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're all about to learn a few things here, and I've been looking forward to this conversation, Doug, because, you know, you promised us John 4, and then you deliver John 1 and John 2 and John 3. I get the feeling that we're just about there.
Well, you know, for you antsy Westerners who just can't wait to dive into something, you know, maybe this has been a good learning experience.
Well, it's been an exercise in patience. It has been. But we've learned a lot. We've learned a lot in the meantime.
Accumulating context that will further illuminate the passage we're really intrigued with.
Well, you know, you've got that right. Because and for those of you not acquainted with hearing context, it's like injecting a whole new dimension into your scripture understanding. It becomes full color, three-dimensional, just pops out of there like one of those greeting cards. You unfold and it becomes a three-dimensional, you know, representation. You learn huge stuff and just how much power is packed into these passages. John 4, Jesus and his disciples have they've left the Jordan. A dispute with John the Baptist? Was there some jealousy, some professional jealousy there?
Well, I'm going to be the rabbi here for 10 minutes and ask you those kind of questions, but let's read the first six verses of John 4, and then my question back to the two of you is, what jumps out at you? What makes you curious? What do you find intriguing? What new questions are raised or posed in these opening six verses of John 4, where John records on his scroll, "Therefore, when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus, Yeshua, was making and baptizing more disciples than John," parenthesis, although Jesus himself was not baptizing, but his disciples were, close parenthesis, "Jesus left Judea." In fact, the translation I like best here, the Wiest expanded Greek New Testament, has "he abruptly left Judea." Mm. "And went away again into the Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near the piece of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph." It's where Joseph is buried. "And Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, being wearied from his journey, was sitting thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour." Now, I think you two are old enough that you've seen people with grandchildren. Maybe you have some yourself. Mm-hmm. Have you run across the Curious George books? Well, when reading the scripture, we have to be curious about the passage, about the text, about the words we're given, about the names we're given, about the sites we're given, about the adjectives that are being used. It's as if we're like Columbo, the late Peter Falk in Columbo, who said, "Can I ask you one more question?" We need to be always asking one more question of the text, to interrogate it, because that's when some of the contextual issues will start to surface. And so now you're ready for my opening question to the two of you. In those first six verses of John 4, what do you find curious? What questions pop into your mind?
The first thing that popped into my mind was it was that parenthetical statement. Although Jesus himself was not baptizing, I want to know why. I'm a little surprised that he wouldn't be, but he would maybe delegate it. Was it something he would delegate to his disciples, or was this a habit that the disciples had formed? That was the procedure they kind of figured they would do because they used to follow John, and that's what he did. I don't know. That parenthetical statement. How do you explain that?
Well, there's some thought possibilities there. Perhaps John is distinguishing what John the Baptist did and what Jesus did. Maybe John the Baptist himself baptized people, and in contrast, Jesus did not himself. Another way to look at this would be that maybe Jesus did not want to set two brands of followers in motion after his death and resurrection, those that had been personally baptized by him and those that were not. Maybe he was envisioning those kind of potential issues, and so he wanted to head that off at the pass. These are fairly brand new disciples of his. Maybe he just wanted to give them a good training experience. There's a number of ways that we can look at this.
Did he maybe not want to overshadow John? Because it says before that parenthetical statement that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John. That suggests a certain competitiveness that maybe Jesus did not like.
Well, I'm not sure it was competitive between Jesus and John, but perhaps the Pharisees saw it through competitive eyes. And Jesus, getting a sense of that, became very, very concerned, not wanting to set up any rivalry at all between those who had been baptized by John and those who had been baptized by the disciples of Jesus. That's a possibility, but I do think the aroma of rivalry and competition from the perspectives of the Pharisees is a reasonable assumption to bring to this passage.
David?
But there must be more things that you're curious about.
Well, yeah. David, do you have a thought?
One of the lines that I was curious about was verse 4. My version says, "And he had to pass through Samaria," as opposed to just wanted to pass or was passing. Or, I mean, normally I would suggest, you know, in my pre-Doug days, I would just look at that word and say, "Well, that's just one of those little phrases or words that they tossed in there." But now I look at every little jot and tittle and say, aha, there's something there. So why did he have to pass through Samaria?
And that's a great question. Do you recall or can you remember the typical explanation that's been given for that?
It had to do with politics and had to do with warring tribes. There were certain areas that were set aside for Gentiles and certain areas that were set aside for Jews. And then there were Roman-dominated areas as well.
Jim, any observations on had?
Well, I think he intended to go that way all along. And it may have been the most efficient way to get north, too. It would have been probably the shortest route. He would have had to have traveled a bumpier road to get around Samaria than to go through it. But I think he knew what was going to happen, and that this visit with the woman at the well was on his itinerary.
Typically, the majority of commentators look at had and do the Samaritan Jewish bitter animosity approach to that by saying no Jew worthy of his faith would ever consider walking through Samaria to go from Jerusalem north to the Galilee, that they would go east from Jerusalem first down the Wadi Kilt to Jericho and then go north along the Jordan Valley and then cross over the Jordan when you got south of the Sea of Galilee and then finish up your journey to get to Capernaum along the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. And this discussion points out why biblical geography often matters. You could do it that way. But here's the catch. It would be a seven-day walk. And if you're an observant Jew, you've got this thing called the Shabbat, the Sabbath, when you can do no work, which means walking as well. You're very limited walking. And therefore, if you wanted to get between Jerusalem up to Capernaum, and you wanted to avoid Samaria, you had to take another route, and that would be 7 days in length, and that would really mess up your life. You could not do all your traveling in the 6 days between the Sabbath. And another thing jumps out at you when you're looking at a map of that period of time. You realize that, yes, you can go north along, or along the Jordan River, particularly on the eastern side, but you have to cross over to get back to the Galilean region, and that forces you to walk right through the Decapolis, the land of evil, the land that Jews are forbidden to walk through. So the geographical argument that Jesus had to go through Samaria, then the reason that he would try to avoid that is because of logistical transportation, walking route reasons, really is sort of weak. I think, Jim, you're closer to it here. There's a divine mandate in this word had. You know, that's why our context matters here. He's just had an encounter with Nicodemus, the best and the brightest of the Jewish establishment, a Pharisee's Pharisee, a member of the Sanhedrin, and he didn't get it. And so Jesus is now going to go to the very other extreme, from the creme de la creme of observant Judaism to the lowest of the outcast in Samaria to bring his good news, and maybe she will get it. So for me, looking at all the pieces of this context here, I think the had has much more to do with the divine mandate than it has to do with logistical issues and the traditional understanding that, of course, Jews will always avoid Samaria when they're walking north.
That's really an exquisite point and takes us into Jesus' mind just a bit. I'm wondering also, now this was at the beginning of his ministry, very early on. His disciples were brand new. Might this have been a part of their training?
Well, yes and no, except a few verses later on, we're going to find out that Jesus sends them away from this well. He doesn't want them around when he engages this Samaritan woman. He's in the town to buy food, which, by the way, sort of destroys the traditional argument right there that Jews and Samaritans don't have any interactions with each other. Jesus is willing to send his fairly new disciples into, presumably, Sychar here, not only to walk into a Samaritan town, but to buy Samaritan bread. So some of our traditional myths that we've created between Samaritans and Jews sort of get obliquely obliterated here in this passage. But I really find it curious, and we'll probably won't get to that until next week, but Jesus does not want his brand new disciples or fairly new disciples around on this one because they just may mess it up.
Still, I would think after the event, Jesus would have had to explain to them what was going on.
Oh, I'm sure once it was over, he did. And he may have talked about fields white unto harvest, and that includes Samaritans as well. And but these guys haven't been around long enough to get over all the prejudices that they inherited from observant Judaism, their historical faith, and their disdain for Samaritans, and the shock looked on their face when Jesus starts to interact with this woman may have been off-putting enough that would it have caused the Samaritan woman to clam up rather than to start to open up with Jesus. And so I'm really find it curious, and we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here, is that Jesus doesn't want the disciples intimately involved in the details of this particular encounter as it unfolds.
Well, I think his mission was with the young woman and with the village, ultimately, and not so much with the disciples. Now, it says he was sitting thus by the well, so I picture the wells as along the routes as kind of rest stops, huh? Must have been where travelers would gather, as well as locals at certain times of the day when they would draw water from the well.
Whether all wells, you know, were surrounded by a low ledge that allowed you to sit on, I don't know. It appears that this one was. This is a little bit outside of town. Typically, you're going to travel 16 to 18 miles a day. Water is very, very scarce. Relatively speaking, in the Middle East. And so there's every reason to believe that you would choose a route that would also be coincident with your water needs as you went throughout the day. But read a little more carefully here. What else do we know about Jesus as he's sitting around this well?
Well, he was wearied from his journey. It was about the sixth hour, which would have been noon, huh?
Does that raise a question?
Well, I'm thinking it was hot, and normally that's not an hour when people would show up at the well. But she did.
Does it raise another question?
Well, why would she be there by? Because normally that's a group thing, isn't it? The women get together. It's like a household chore.
We're skirting a little bit ahead here.
Okay.
But here's my question. Mm-hmm. This is what got me really intrigued with these first six verses. Why in the world are you weary at noontime? You should be weary at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night after you've walked 16 or 18 miles a day. But this is very, very early in an Israelite day here. And I find it puzzling that he's already, some texts call it exhausted, mm-hmm. by noontime. Now, what in the world would cause you to be exhausted at noontime?
Did he walk
overnight? Walking.
David, what were you saying?
Well, I was going to suggest he walked overnight, or he did an overnight trip. If he started the night before because of whatever reason, but Doug just said it's not walking. I don't know.
Let's assume he walked through the night, okay? That would be highly unusual. What in the world would cause a person to walk through the night?
Secrecy?
Yeah, I mean, you've mentioned a couple of times that by this time he's well known. The soldiers are out looking for him. I mean, there are informants everywhere. People are on the lookout. So maybe walking at night would be, in spite of the bandits and the wild animals, that, you know, would be a calculated chance that he would have to take,
Doug, you've told us, Doug, that traveling at night was common because of the heat.
Yeah, it depends on what...
What season, I suppose.
What season? I mean, you wouldn't walk through the night. You might walk until 10 or 11 p.m. Mm-hmm. But see, this causes me to really get captivated by the word that Kenneth Wiest uses in his expanded Greek New Testament, that Jesus abruptly left Judea. I wonder if there's a sense of urgency here.
I wonder if he was being pursued.
Or was concerned about being pursued.
Yes.
Or was concerned about the safety of his disciples. Now, why would that be?
He had gotten word that he'd been sold out, that somebody had said he was going to be somewhere. I'm trying to remember what happened just before this.
Well, let's go way back.
Nicodemus.
To verse 1 and 2. Therefore, when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John. What do we know about John?
Well, he was...
He was in prison.
Of the priestly line. Well, not yet. I don't think he was in prison yet. Was he? No.
No.
That comes later. We know John baptized in the Jordan, that he'd baptized Jesus. It initiated Jesus' own ministry. We know that that the Pharisees had been watching John in detail to see who he was and had questioned him about who he was, who he thought he was, what he was doing there.
And why were they watching John carefully?
He was on a couple of watch lists from the Romans, potential rebels, potential uprising. He was gathering a crowd. He was possibly somebody who would cause trouble in the Roman Empire.
Well, he was kind of an insurrectionist too. He preached against the religious establishment, against the whole animal sacrificial system. That was the meaning of his repent. You've taught us that, Doug. That repent.
Yeah,
was,
and I think David hit on a key word here: insurrection.
Ah.
There's always the concern. Obviously in the Romans, but in those Jewish leadership, the aristocracy who's in bed with the Romans, is we can't let insurrection, revolt, take place in this land, or we're going to lose our privileged position, our ability to run Temple Incorporated, our capacity to milk this cash cow for all it's worth. And so always on the lookout for insurrection, for rebellion, is something that's just in the background here. It's always in the background here. So John the Baptist shows up, and he has a ministry of protest. against everything that's taking place with the aristocracy, with the chief priests and the high priests in Jerusalem. They are all dressed in fine Babylonian linen. So John, as a protest, is dressed in camel hair, the coat of the prophetic voice. They're eating scrumptious foods, and he's eating locusts and honey. And locust could be understood as from the locust bean, from the locust plant, not necessarily the grasshopper thing. But he's eating kosher. They're set up in Jerusalem at the temple. He's out in the wilderness. He needs to be seen as a complete protest against the Jewish religious establishment in Jerusalem, who everybody in the land knows is corrupt. Okay? It's no secret. All of that, and I could put more of that background in place, but John the Baptist, we'll get to his name in a minute here, is becoming the de facto high priest of the land, okay? And so that's why he's on the watch list. And now somebody else shows up on the Judean landscape. His name is Yeshua. And do you think Yeshua, in one afternoon, developed a following that was larger than John's? No.
Probably not.
It's going to take several weeks, couple months, okay, to develop that sort of notoriety, that sort of following for the word to spread. If it were not for this passage in John, we would never know that Jesus had part of his ministry in Judea. Isn't that an interesting thought?
Mm-hmm.
And here's another one. When we add up the number of days that we find in the gospel record of the life of Jesus, we have about 30 days. And yet his was a three-year ministry. That's 1,000 days. So there's an awful lot of days that are unaccounted for in terms of what Jesus was doing and where he was. So I want to suggest to you that it appears, just from a little bit of logic here, that Jesus must have been in Judea here for a couple of months, teaching every single day until the word spread, people started to come, word of mouth continued to spread, more people began to come. Jesus now gets on the radar screen along with John. The note-taking dirty trick squads come out, start sending reports back to Jerusalem. And one of their reports one day said, you know, it's getting so big here, it's getting so potentially out of hand that he's now baptizing even more disciples than John himself.
Okay.
If I can quote Tom Hanks from the movie Apollo 13, Jerusalem, we have a problem.
Can I digress for just a second?
Do you ever?
Yeah, no, I've never done this. I know I never do this. I it's totally uncharacteristic. There was a story yesterday in, I've forgotten where I heard it, but Rand Paul, the libertarian Republican, is gaining a lot of favor. And yesterday, a couple of establishment Republican types were attacking him for something. For isolationist. Not wanting to entangle ourselves in wars outside of the country. And it was four or five Republicans that ganged up on Paul and started attacking him. Now, somebody looked at that story and said, that means that Rand Paul is the new leader in the polls. He is the new guy at the top of the heap. And that's not so bad, because popularity is popularity, comes and goes. What they're concerned about, especially Republican types, especially established Republican types, you might say Pharisee Republicans, is that here's the new guy that's going to take the party away. And they're going to lose all their sense of privilege and all their, all their limos and all their, going to fundraisers and parties and all the rest of that. I just find, it struck me as an interesting comparison that the regulars, the guys who should have been on your side, all of a sudden look around and say, "Ooh, I think we better watch this guy. This guy's trouble."
And not only that, Doug, but Jesus and his disciples, that's a good parallel, David. But Jesus was headed into an area, headed north toward Galilee, which was known for its insurrectionists and extreme views, wasn't it?
Yeah, but let's not leave Judea too quickly here.
Oh, okay.
What do you think Jesus' message was for the couple of months, I'm guessing here, that he was teaching every day on the Judean landscape?
Well, about the new kingdom. The kingdom of God is at hand.
Oh, does that sound like insurrectionist stuff?
Yeah, I think it does.
There's a new kingdom in the land?
Uh-huh. There's a new sheriff in town.
Yeah. And we have to, well, what have we got here? 4 minutes left. We have to peel this word baptizing back. What does it mean to get baptized in this culture?
Well, be initiated into the new faith. It's kind of the symbolic opening of the door into the new existence, the new life.
Well, it's all of that, but we're probably better served if we don't use the word baptized.
Okay.
That's a transliteration from the Greek word baptismo, but really the word, if we walked into a Judean village in the first century through some time warp machine here and said, where can we get baptized? I mean, they would just look at us with a puzzled look. Mm-hmm. They have no idea what that word means, because in this culture, you get immersed.
Hmm.
You get ducked underwater. Okay, and it has to be a certain kind of water, water that's moving. Okay, that's called living water. That's actually going to show up later here in John 4. But the thing we miss contextually is there are five reasons why people get immersed in this first century setting. And one is to identify with a particular teaching of a rabbi. Okay? That's just one of the five reasons you get immersed. And so Jesus may have been talking about a new kingdom, and hundreds of people a day are now getting immersed by Jesus' disciples say, I want to identify with this teaching. Yes, we need a new kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Houston, we have a problem.
Yeah.
And so I'm, you know, connecting the dots here, and you probably have to be cut a little bit of slack here to do that contextually. But when you put enough pieces together, I think Jerusalem is beginning to say, we have a bigger issue than John the Baptizer. And this is getting out of hand. Should we start to do something about this now? Do we need to nip this thing in the bud? And it may well be that Jesus at that moment in time got a glimpse as to what his future in Jerusalem was ultimately going to be.
Hmm.
The cross and a death. Mm-hmm. And a resurrection. And for those reasons alone, he said, hey guys, we're leaving Dodge ASAP. Follow me. We're heading north. And it was an abrupt departure from Jerusalem. And perhaps the emotional weight of that is why he is so weary when he arrives at noonday in Shechem. He's been processing this all night. Maybe he laid on the ground, but maybe he didn't sleep as he got a glimpse into his future. And that may be why he is so exhausted, because I think all of us are familiar with the fact that emotional stress can fatigue us just as much as physical stress.
And this would have been new to him. This, again, is at the beginning of his ministry. He's just starting to sense the nature of the opposition, perhaps.
John is all about the conflicts of Jesus. That's the theme that John works over and over again. And this may be the very first time, it's implicitly here, where Jesus realizes the conflict that he's heading into.
Interesting, interesting. And something tells me we have a ways to go before we meet that woman at the well.
Well, we're getting close, though.
We're getting close. Okay. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. The ministry's been around for, what now, 20 years?
It goes back to 2000, so let's say 14 years.
And there's a marvelous website. You can link to it from ours. It's Preserving Bible Times, like it's all one word, preservingbibletimes.org. And if you're listening on brokenroadradio.com this morning, with a click you can get there. It's a gorgeous new website. Lots of photographs from Doug's recent trip on his Pauline Studies tour of Italy there. And you'll find that there are resources galore for your church, for your small groups and Bible studies, things just to even our Digging Deeper series that we run here on the Broken Road Radio is available on CD there. You can use that to stimulate discussion in your small groups and Bible studies. So, Doug, as always, we're grateful for your time and your wisdom, and we'll look forward to next week.
David, sail on.
Yes, I'll keep my anchor up.
Well, you might want to let it down now and then, Dave. But
let it down now.
That's what it's for. It doesn't do any good in the boat. It just kind of gets in the way there. Oh, Doug Greenwald, we'll talk to you in a week. Okay.
Shalom, guys.
Shalom.
See you, Doug. Shalom.